If you own a business or run an organization, consider using IPR as part of your marketing strategy. Let us show you how to reach our loyal radio audience, advertise on our digital platforms, and even sponsor your favorite podcast. Spread the word about your business and support IPR at the same time. It's a win-win. Learn more at iowapublicradio.org/sponsors.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later this hour, Stephen Gruber-Miller with an update on Iowa State House news. Also, Jason Clayworth of Axios tells us why in Des Moines, activists have condemned the mayor's proposal for more city hall security. But first, a few days ago, I received my first dose of Pfizer in Coralville at the University of Iowa Healthcare Support Service Building. What an impressive operation that was. You know, at first I thought I joined this stream of cars down the access road to the facility for my appointment. I was so concerned with so many people coming for their appointments at this one facility. Is it going to be well organized? I thought. Well, as it turned out, I was in excellent hands. I was directed to parking, ushered in the main door, where it was just wonderful.
What do you need from me?
I just need your last name.
Kiefer, K-I-E-F-F-E-R.
As you hear, I was registered. Super friendly people the whole way, brought to a cubicle in a large room where dozens of people were getting shots. And, of course, everyone masked. A friendly nurse, Heather, asking me a few questions, giving me the jab, then off to a waiting room for a few minutes. I was back out in my car in less than 20 minutes. So a big shout out to the University of Iowa Hospitals for being so well organized, professional, and friendly. And I'm sure these mass vaccinations are going really well in other parts of the state as well. At the start of the week, all adult Iowans became eligible to receive a COVID-19 vaccine. Let's get a sense of how the week went with Michaela Ram, healthcare reporter with the Gazette. Hi again, Michaela.
Hi, and congrats on the vaccine.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, those are the appropriate words in this day and age. Congratulations. Yeah. Overall, what is your sense of how the first week went with expanded eligibility in Iowa?
Yeah, overall, from my sense, things seemed to go according to plan. There was no big crisis, nothing too major happened from my understanding. It seemed, in my sense, to be kind of the same as it was. You know, supply is limited and a lot of people are looking for vaccines. So public health officials continue to emphasize that you may have to be patient when you're getting your appointment. But the good news is there seem to be a lot more vaccines making their way into the community. I saw the CDC has Iowa is one of the top states as far as total doses administered per 100,000 people in the population. So good news is there's more and more vaccines available, and eventually people will be able to get the shot if they want one.
Right. And I understand, though, for organizers, there's a bit of a downside for all these people being successful in getting their appointments. The cancellations have become a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen a lot of conversation about this on the Iowa Vaccines Alert Twitter page, which is a great site in terms of aggregating and finding out where appointments are available. Brian, the individual who runs that, was talking about he's hearing from public health officials that people will sort of shop around for appointments. You know, they'll grab an appointment somewhere out away from them and then keep looking for that appointment. And as soon as they find one closer to them, they'll cancel that initial appointment, which makes it a challenge for those local public health officials. It makes it hard for them to plan and organize their event if people keep canceling on them.
This past Wednesday, as I'm sure you know, Michaela, the governor said she is against the idea of so-called vaccine passports and would take action to make sure they do not go into effect here in Iowa. Let's hear a little bit of what she had to say during her press conference.
While I believe in the efficacy of the vaccine enough to get it myself and encourage Iowans to do the same, I also respect that it's a personal choice. But I strongly oppose vaccine passports, and I believe that we must take a stand as a state against them, which I intend to do either through legislation or executive action. I will also continue to do my part to educate and encourage Iowans about the importance of being vaccinated. But as I said, we will take action either through the legislature or with executive action against vaccine passports.
In that press conference, the governor also said there are all kinds of questions that are really raised with moving in that direction: privacy implications, HIPAA, First and Fourth Amendment rights, Americans with disability, some of the things she mentioned. Michaela, help us understand in a concise way, what is the debate here on both sides, the arguments over this vaccine passport?
So just briefly, those in favor of it are in favor of it because, you know, they see this as a good way to ensure that the virus doesn't spread and that people can take precautions if somebody is coming to an area that is not vaccinated. But on the other side, like you said, there are a lot of concerns to those who are opposed to a vaccine passport like this. So there are a lot of people who face barriers to getting the vaccine. And basically, the argument is people shouldn't be limited based on their vaccine status, especially if they face barriers. You know, people are concerned about their privacy, what entities may know their health status in terms of what vaccine they may have. And otherwise, you know, people are worried that if they choose not to get the vaccine for whatever reason, that they could be punished in a way by not being allowed to travel if they don't have that vaccine passport.
Right. It's a big name. It's an impressive name, vaccine passport, but it's just a credential to show that a person has been vaccinated. It's really just a digitized sort of little piece of paper that has your vaccine information on it. And to put this in a little bit of context, I mean, for years, when people travel to some parts of the world, they need to show vaccination against malaria and other things. And more recently, we've had to show, you know, for some airlines or traveling internationally, you show that you've been tested for the coronavirus. So it makes one wonder how different this is to have a vaccine passport.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't seem different at all. Like you said, there's a lot of requirements for traveling to certain countries in terms of vaccine or your healthcare, I guess you could argue. But, you know, and also in terms of allowing this, you know, when you travel to a lot of countries, oftentimes international travels have to go through a lot of hoops. You know, they have to be in quarantine for 2 weeks and you have to go through all these steps because you are traveling internationally. So this is kind of, people see this as an extension of that, you know, having that little code to show that when you are entering the country, you have that protection against the virus.
And at the start, before we started this conversation, you heard a little bit of my experience getting my first dose of the Pfizer vaccine in a large setting where there were just hundreds of people going through, and it was run so well by the University of Iowa hospitals. These sort of large-scale college and university vaccination campaigns are going on across the state. What have you found out here?
I believe Iowa State is looking to start one here soon, and I know the governor has touted support of using the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to vaccinate college students. You know, we're toward the end of the spring semester, and I think there's a lot of concern that as these young adults start leaving campus and start returning home or returning to wherever they're going for the summer break, that could be a vector for spreading the virus further, and they want to offer protection to those people around them. There has also been concern about that, though, from some public health officials. You know, I wrote a story earlier about a Linn County public health official who wrote a letter to the state expressing concern about the fact that these college students would be getting Johnson & Johnson vaccines. You know, that's the one-shot COVID-19 vaccine, the only one we have currently. The public health officials really wanted to use that for vulnerable populations, you know, populations that can't easily make it to vaccine clinics. And so that's sort of been a point of contention going into this.
All right, Michaela Ram, healthcare reporter with the Gazette. You can follow Michaela on Twitter at Michaela_Ram. That's Ram with two M's. Michaela, thanks for the update. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we're entering the final weeks of the 2021 legislative session. Let's check in with Stephen Gruber-Miller, State House reporter with the Des Moines Register. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, Ben.
Let's talk about a number of stories that you've covered this week, starting off with broadband, where you reported Iowa lawmakers passing a bill to boost internet access in the state. This is one of the governor's priorities. Tell us about it.
That's right. Lawmakers this week approved a matching grant program that would create an incentive structure for companies that provide broadband to receive money from the state if they're providing it in harder to reach areas that don't currently have high speed internet. So there's no funding attached to this yet. This is just the structure for how the grants will work. The companies have to provide internet that reaches a certain speed for uploads and downloads in order to qualify, and the grant, the percentage match is larger in areas that have greater need of internet.
Okay, so targeting mostly our rural areas, in other words, right?
Correct.
Okay. Do Democrats support this bill as well?
Yeah, this is something that passed unanimously. Like I said, this is just the structure of the program, and so what comes next is lawmakers have to agree on a funding level. Governor Reynolds, as you mentioned, this is one of her priorities. She's called for $150 million a year for 3 years. House Republicans have proposed $100 million this year, and the Senate Republicans have said that their number will be significant, but I haven't seen a number yet, so they have to come to an agreement there.
Mm-hmm. Any idea or any talk of how this will be financed, these grants?
The House has said that they will probably use general fund dollars, but I think there's also some federal money available through the recent stimulus package that could be used towards broadband. So they're looking at the federal guidance and waiting for additional federal guidance to see if they'll be able to use some of that money for this as well.
Toward the end of the session, always the budget needs to be finalized and debated. And this year, the deaths of a nurse and a correctional officer at the Anamosa State Penitentiary 2 weeks ago have prompted a new debate over the size of a budget increase for the Iowa Department of Corrections as part of the overall annual budget debate. Tell us, so what are the proposals and disagreements here? A recognized chronic understaffing, a shortage of staff in our corrections department, right?
So yeah, these tragic deaths have really, supercharged, I guess, the debate over the funding level for the Department of Corrections. The number that House Republicans have proposed, it's between $20 and $21 million of an increase. They say that's the largest increase in 10 years. They feel like that really meets the needs of the department. Democrats and union officials who represent prison workers say that's not really solving the problem. There's been, as you mentioned, chronic understaffing. They say that there's positions, more positions than this money would cover, that need to be filled. They also want to broaden out the conversation and say that it should also be about things like allowing workers to negotiate over safety conditions in their workplace. In 2017, Republicans passed a change to Iowa's collective bargaining law that limited the topics that public sector workers could bargain over. And so they feel like that's an issue because they say that workers can't talk to their employer, the state of Iowa, about safety conditions in the prisons.
Right. And to pull a quote from your article on this, this is a quote from Danny Holman, a union leader representing the Anamosa prison workers. You quote him as saying, "I hate to be the guy that turns my nose up at getting $20 million additional funding, but that $20 million doesn't cover the salary increases of the last 2 years." That puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah. And so it's the Republicans are saying that, if they allocate this money to the Department of Corrections, it could be used for filling vacant positions. It could be used for salary. It could be used for sort of a combination of both of those. So they say it's not quite as simple as there are outstanding salary needs that exceed that $20 million total. But they say that the department has some flexibility if they want to hire some additional workers.
Let's talk about one more issue at the State House. More efforts this week by Republicans on this proposed amendment that states that the Iowa Constitution, if this change would be in there, does not secure a right to abortion. What happened this week in that? Well, it is a necessarily and intentionally long road to get a change to our Iowa Constitution.
Right. Changing the Iowa Constitution, yeah, it takes several years. The legislature has to pass the same language multiple times in different general assemblies, meaning that we have to go through an election and then they have to pass the same language again. What happened this week was the Iowa Senate passed an amended version of this proposal that the House had already passed earlier this year. So since the Iowa Senate changed the language slightly, it has to go back to the House, and the House will have to pass it again with the same language in order for it to sort of complete, check the box for, yes, they've passed it this year. So while the House and Senate proposals are pretty similar, there are some differences in language there, and it seems like they don't necessarily have an agreement on what exactly that language should be.
Remind us, give us some background here about, Stephen, why Republicans say this amendment is needed. What prompted it?
So this has been sort of in the works since a 2018 Iowa Supreme Court decision found that the Iowa Constitution does protect a fundamental right to abortion. Republicans say that that right doesn't exist in the Iowa Constitution, and they want to pass this amendment to make clear that the Constitution does not secure or protect this right to abortion that the court decision found.
As you brought out in your reporting, this could reach the ballot for you and I and other residents of Iowa to vote on in 2024. That gets to the question of what do we know about Iowans' attitudes towards such an amendment change?
So, yeah, and again, they have to agree on the language this year and then pass the same language after the 2022 election in order for it to go on the ballot. But if it does, you know, the Des Moines Register has done polling on this. I think it's fewer than a third of people are supportive. I could be quoting that wrong. But it's more opposed than support this particular amendment. So, Republicans are hopeful that if it's put on the ballot, that people will agree with them and they'll, decide that this is something they want to do. But it would have to reach 50% plus one, vote of a statewide vote of all the people of Iowa. So it could go. We don't know which way it would go.
All right. Okay. We'll watch that. Thank you for your great reporting, Stephen Gruber-Miller, State House reporter with the Des Moines Register. You can follow Stephen on Twitter at sgrubermiller. And Stephen, we'll look forward to having you on the program again soon. Take care.
Thanks very much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week in Des Moines, activists condemned Mayor Frank County's proposal for more City Hall security. Joining us with that story, Jason Clayworth, reporter with Axios Des Moines. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Ben.
So why would the mayor, Mayor County, call for more security? That call be controversial?
Well, so there have been issues that have been percolating for years, and they've been focused somewhat on police profiling. So that's been an issue that's been ongoing. And in the past year, tensions have spiked following the death of George Floyd. And since then, there's been a lot more tension between the public and the council, and some members of the public encouraging the council to go further on police reform, and that's really what's driving the conversation. And there is, with this tension, are folks that are what the mayor considers to be disruptive during the council meetings.
I don't know if you've been to the council meetings. What kind of disruptions are we talking about?
The George Floyd incident and the pandemic kind of came together as during the same time, and so council meetings are now virtual. And so what's going on is that there are multiple speakers that have very strong opinions. They often use profanity at some of the council members. And the council members, the discussion between them, it's very divisive. The mayor is concerned that some of the hostility that's been going on in my conversation with him, he's concerned that some of this could spill over into something more serious than an exchange of words. In my conversation, he made note of violence across the country, but especially chilling was his reference to the 1987 incident in which a disgruntled citizen, burst into Mount Pleasant City Council meeting and shot and killed the former mayor, Ed King. And as you may remember, this is when Tom Vilsack was appointed mayor and prior to his role as governor and U.S. Secretary of Agriculture.
So Mayor County is suggesting what increased security specifically?
The mayor is at this point thinking of multiple ideas of how to handle this. He's, again, concerned about public safety, not just of council members, but for the general public. And there's two key things that he's thinking about. One is a weapons ban at City Hall. And currently, City Hall does not have metal detectors. And so that is one idea that the mayor is considering. And he's also considering whether there are steps that to limit speakers that are especially abusive or break decorum. And this is important because generally there are First Amendment rights with folks that can approach city council. But what is important about this is that the council currently has time that it allows the public to speak, but there is nothing in Iowa law that mandates the council to have that public input. Its meetings must be public under Iowa law, but it is not required to provide citizens with input. And so there are some, the mayor did not say this, but there are some that have said to us, we are concerned that the Des Moines City Council will completely end public input during its public meeting session. And so this could have serious implications on anybody that wants to address the council.
Mm-hmm. And of course, when the council meetings are no longer virtual and people are all gathered in a room together, then you have a different dimension of concerns, don't you?
Absolutely true. And again, I mean, this, you know, the mayor is thinking ahead a few months. In his conversation with me, he says, I'm thinking ahead a few months when these meetings resume. And so that's really where he is focused. And at this point, he has not put forward a specific plan. It's something that he plans to discuss further with the city council. And obviously, whatever is proposed will be an item of intense scrutiny and discussion from people who rightfully want the access to, you know, our top city elected officials.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jason Clayworth. Hey, before we go, people have been hearing, well, it's not been very long that people have been hearing this term Axios, your news organization, Axios Des Moines. Quickly, before we say goodbye, what is Axios Des Moines? Where did it come from?
Sure. Axios is a news organization. We've been around for 4 years. 5 years, we've been focusing on, you know, we started on more national type politics, but we are breaking off and we're doing more community reporting, including Des Moines. And so we have a Des Moines newsletter. It comes out. It's free 5 times a week. And we focus on the city of Des Moines.
Okay, Axios Des Moines. Jason Clayworth there, reporter with Axios Des Moines. Thank you very much. We'll check in with you again in the future.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up, a view from the Des Moines International Airport with the expected uptick of air travel. We'll hear from Kayla Kavarna at the Des Moines International Airport. But that's when News Buzz continues. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Get your news may have changed during this pandemic, but you still need to know what's going on in our state every day. IPR News has you covered. Subscribe to our new podcast, Hear First, and start your day equipped with the essential local news you need to know, delivered in under 15 minutes, weekdays by 7 a.m. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters. Learn about what's going on at the State House and on the ground in your community. Subscribe to Hear First today, wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we heard in our news in the past few days, the CDC issued new guidance saying that fully vaccinated people can travel safely without quarantining or testing before or after the travel. We were also reminded by the CDC of their recommendation against traveling has not changed. They continue to advise against non-essential trips given the current rise in COVID cases. Nevertheless, we are, it's clear, seeing a light at the end of this dark pandemic tunnel, and that means a return to more air travel. Let's check in with Kayla Kavarna. She's Communications, Marketing, and Air Service Development Manager at the Des Moines International Airport. Kayla, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Well, what does it feel like at the Des Moines International Airport? Feeling any upswing and anticipation, or what does it feel like?
We certainly are. There's a growing energy related to travel. We are seeing some more cars in the parking lots and feet here passing through the terminal.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit, take us to the darkest days in terms of air travel for you at the Des Moines International Airport. Can you approximately say when that was and how much percentage-wise you had of your sort of pre-COVID traffic?
Yeah, you bet. So we are about a year from our darkest days. So, you know, certainly last year, mid-March is when things started kind of hitting in a big way and travel started to begin to flow. And then in April, it almost halted. We were down by 95.5% when we compared to 2019. So there were not many people. It felt a bit like a ghost town here at the airport. And so looking a year ago, much different picture than where we are today. We are seeing more folks coming through the terminal. A few people even in business suits, which indicates that some businesses are starting to look at resuming travel. But spring break was a big boost for us here in 2021.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you were down 95% in a year ago, April of 2020. And so percentage-wise, can you say where you are now, approximately, a year later?
Yeah, so our March statistics aren't done yet, but much better picture. I can tell you that looking at last week, just the number of people coming through the TSA checkpoint, we were down by about 38%. So a huge improvement there from 95% down to, you know, 38% down.
And what are you and others at the Des Moines International Airport expecting in the coming weeks of spring into summer?
Well, this spring break, we had great numbers coming through. Through typically April, it slows a little bit. That's more of a business boom for us, which is a little bit slower to rebound. But summertime is big for us. So we're really hopeful that individuals are looking at traveling and booking again. Certainly, we want everybody to feel safe and confident when they choose to fly. But as more vaccines are available, we do believe we're going to see more people booking travel through the summer and into the fall as well.
Mm-hmm. As you ramp up the number of passengers coming through your airport, are you in need of calling staff back? Are you at full staffing already?
Yes, we are in the fortunate position that we were able to retain our full staff throughout the pandemic. Very fortunate to do so. We did receive some CARES Act funding that helped us to do that. So we've been full staffed. Certainly the airlines, they staff their own employees. And as more airplanes are booked to be flying in and out of the Des Moines International Airport, they will staff accordingly. So we're pretty fortunate that we are here and we are ready to welcome people back.
Mm-hmm. As you know, listening to the news, and we talked about it earlier this hour with the Gazette's health reporter, vaccine passports are making headlines and eliciting some emergency measures by governors in a handful of states, including here in Iowa, where Governor Reynolds is against the idea of these so-called passports. A passport, again, just a credential to show that a person has been vaccinated, as simple as a digitized little piece of paper with your vaccine information on it. I wonder, Kayla, what is the position of your airport, the Des Moines International Airport, on so-called vaccine passports?
Well, it certainly is a hot button topic publicly and here at the airport too. I wouldn't say we have a specific position on whether there should be one or not. Our goal really is to make sure that travelers understand what they need so that they can fly to their desired destination. So we're following and monitoring the issue pretty closely. But to your point, you know, the concept doesn't seem to have a lot of support from local state government here as well as in some other states. And then the federal government has also mentioned that at this time, they are not pursuing that as something that needs to happen. It does seem to be something that's more supported by the private sector as a way to get that confidence level back so that businesses can open up and kind of return to normal. So I can understand both sides, but we really are neutral on the position. We just want to be here to welcome folks back and make sure they have what they need and feel comfortable resuming travel.
Right. I understand that completely. Unfortunately, like masks and vaccines, these vaccine passports have become politicized, sort of a a third rail that many are watching out for when it's talked about. Talk a little bit more about safety, because a year into this pandemic, our whole society has learned so much. Of course, air travel and the precautions there. How much risk right now is there to a passenger traveling through the Des Moines International Airport to board and plane and deplane?
Sure. Well, I'm not a scientist, so I can't answer that specifically. But what I can tell you is that not only has the airport made sure that we've maintained all of our new health and safety protocols regarding cleaning and sanitizing, masks are mandated here at the International Airport. It is a federal mandate. So whether you've been vaccinated or not, everybody coming through our terminal does need to have a mask covering their nose and mouth. We do definitely have a lot of language reminders and signage informing people to make sure that they're washing their hands frequently. There is hand sanitizer everywhere for people to use. And then I think the other piece is the airlines are still requiring masks as well. And so it's really about creating that safety. I've actually flown and I've had a really great experience. I did wear a mask the entire time. And from what I could tell, everybody around me were wearing their masks. It was being monitored. So I felt safe in doing that. It really comes down to everybody's personal preference and if they feel comfortable traveling. And we are ready and excited to welcome people back to fly. And so when people are ready, we're making it as safe as possible for them to do that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Some insights. What's going on at the Des Moines International Airport? Kayla Kavarna is Communications Marketing and Air Service Development Manager at that airport. Kayla, nice to speak with you. Take care.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. To be at the office for work or not to be at the office? That is the question for many at this time. A year after the pandemic really abruptly forced many of us to start working from home, employers are now getting ready to bring workers back to offices. And that's getting some mixed reactions from employees, I think it's fair to say. Michelle Williams joins me now, Assistant Professor of Management and Entrepreneurship at the University of Iowa's Tippey College of Business. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Ben. It's great to be back.
Well, great to have you. Listeners will remember that we spoke in the very early weeks of the pandemic on this program a year ago when many of us were just, well, I'll speak for myself, fumbling around trying to work from home. We were newbies at remote working, dogs barking, knocks at the door, and all that's become sort of commonplace now. I want to ask you, how would you characterize the phase we are in right now with the mass vaccination campaign picking up speed? We hope we've seen the worst of this pandemic. We still need to mask up and keep social distance, of course, but and also the worry about the virus variants. What are you seeing with that backdrop? What are you seeing, hearing about how employers are dealing with this post-COVID work and what's to come?
So I see the employers and employees alike being very hopeful. So there are a lot of people who want to get back to work to be able to have that culture that that's more harder to maintain online, to be able to drop by people's offices, talk with them, even if it's with a mask, but in person. We're seeing companies, especially in larger cities, looking at the potential gains from having less real estate downtown and having people be able to come in on a more flexible schedule. So I see a lot of pluses and upsides. I also see, as you've probably heard, a lot of, you know, some people are still anxious, right? Some people actually found themselves to be more productive at home, found it easier to integrate their lives as parents when they're being at home and trying to figure out, can they keep up that same how do they keep up that same productivity as they return to work? We have people who are have medical vulnerabilities who are still, because of the new variants, who are still concerned about being in an office kind of full of people who they're not sure, you know, to what degree they're wearing masks when they're not in the office. Mm-hmm. So we see both sides of it, I think.
For you, Michelle, as a researcher there in the field of business management and entrepreneurship, I wonder, What have you been mulling over? The biggest questions you have from your sort of business scholar perspective there. So such a rich environment because business has really been put through so many changes in such a short time.
So that's a great question. So one of the things I study is trust. And what we saw at the beginning of the pandemic is when people were, you know, suddenly going and working from home, that trust that they had built with their managers really paid off it tons. It helped managers, employees trusted managers when they were trying to help them manage the emotions and stress. They took job demands as something that they could really, you know, help others, and we saw them increasing in their, you know, kind of willingness to jump in and pitch in and help. I have a paper with Luba Belkin and some co-authors that will be presented this summer at the Academy of Management. So that was really exciting. But as the pandemic waned on, what we saw is some managers feeling very uncomfortable with having to manage people they couldn't see all the time and trying to implement more tracking kind of software and check-ins and starting to micromanage a little bit. And so what my biggest concern moving forward in the return to work is that if employees and managers have any eroded trust, it's going to make it much harder to have those collaborative relationships when they return. So my advice, or what I would hope managers and employees are doing now, is really trying to make sure that they have that solid foundation, that they can ask questions, that they can bring up new processes that might help their organization and really have voice in how this return to work looks. I think that will make a big difference for how comfortable employees feel with that and how much they can leverage the excitement for some employees wanting to work full time on site and some wanting to still have a more of a flexible work schedule and work some days at home and some days in the office.
Yeah, you're right. For those who want, who like at least some aspects of working from home and have the, let's face it, the room without the distractions, a lot of people don't have that at home. What are the criteria that managers in conversations with their employees should be looking at to determine, well, how much should I continue to work from home? How much from home? How do we know? What are the yardsticks? Do we know what the yardsticks are?
I think some of the yardsticks are really clear because they're how much does the business need you in the office to actually function properly, right? So we can clearly see that for most hospitals, it's much better to have their physicians and their nurses in the hospital because that's just necessary, right? Mm-hmm. There's some telemedicine, so that works. But for the most part, our healthcare workers are on site. And the same thing with some of our other businesses. If we're going to start having customers come in to our offices, we need people there who can answer their questions, who can do all the things that we were doing before the pandemic. But there are some ways where people might be able to trade off. You might not need all 8 people in the office like you had before every day. It might mean that you need, you know, we need 4 people here on site every day, and and we can work with you to figure out which 4 people that is and have that work around people's preferences to work at home. And we know, you know, maybe we're having on-site meetings on Fridays. So I think that based on the real structure of the work, that's going to make a difference. Some work is highly interdependent, and the work turns out better if people can pop in on each other and ask questions, and they don't have to wait, you know, for the email or for the person to, you know, to get to that question. And so some organizations have found that highly collaborative client work really works better when they have their engineering team or something in the software development team co-located. And so I think that the industry is going to really matter there.
Mm, okay, fascinating. Michelle, we'll have to have you on the program for a longer period of time. This was just a short snippet. You've got so many fascinating things, and I know our listeners would want to join in if they could call in. That's not what we do generally on NewsBuzz, but let's book that in the future because this isn't going away. A lot of things are staying that we have learned to do in this pandemic, right? In terms of work.
Oh, definitely. Okay. That would be so much fun. I would love to answer talk with listeners and answer their questions.
Let's make that a date. Thank you, Michelle Williams, Assistant Professor of Management and Entrepreneurship at the University of Iowa's Tippie College of Business. Take care, Michelle. Until next time.
Bye-bye, Ben. Thank you.
And we're finishing up our News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Wow, it's time to groove into the weekend. Helping us do that, Tony Daner is at the steering wheel, driving this bus. And you'll get that reference here in a minute, Tony, right?
Because yes, I will.
They're at the Studio One Tracks host. We just had a super successful fun drive. And specifically for you folks there at the Studio One music end of things, you were looking to raise money for a new set of wheels so you can go out and record all kinds of things in a much better way.
Yes, the new Studio One fan van. That is the goal we are working towards. This is not a luxury vehicle so that we can travel to music festivals in style or anything like that. This is to haul all of our recording and broadcast equipment so that we can go out and do interviews with artists at the Hinterland Festival, so we can do live broadcasts from Studio One Underground, all that stuff. The current vehicle is quite a bit older. The manufacturer no longer makes parts for it, so we need something a little more reliable, and that's where our listeners came in, and they came through for us. So thank you to everyone who contributed.
Okay, Tony Daner, nice you could give us that update. And for those who didn't hear, we did meet our goal overall, IPR's fundraising goal for a spring fundraiser. Huge shout out to those who did chip in or raise their donation level. If you haven't, if you still want a chance to do that, get on board at iowapublicradio.org. Okay, on to grooving into the weekend. Tony, what do you got for us?
Okay, we're going to start with the new album from Flock of Dimes. This came out last Friday. Flock of Dimes, the solo music project of Jen Wozner, who's also part of Y Oak. Her music under Flock of Dimes, I think, is a little more personal. She goes back and forth between guitar and synth sounds. We get both on this new record called Head of Roses. There's a serious electric guitar freak out on the song right before this one, but this is a little synthier, a little more cuddly, if you want to call it that. Flock of Dimes and Two.
I do like it. Flock of Dimes with Two. Tony, I do love that. The voice, the vibe is just wonderful. Thank you for that.
Yeah, it's a great record, yeah.
Okay, take us to number two. We have time for one more to take us out under our credits as well.
Okay, here's a band that's been around for a while with a new record coming in June, Raining Sound. They got their start in Memphis many years ago. The only remaining member, original member for a while, was Greg Cartwright, the lead vocalist who moved to Asheville, North Carolina. He has returned to Memphis, and Ben, they got the band back together. They have reunited the Memphis lineup for the first time since 2005. They've got a new record on the way called Little More Time. We're about to hear the title track. If you're really into that Bob Dylan and the Band basement tape sound, I think you're really going to like this song. This is A Little More Time from Raining Sound.
Stitches, but you don't heed the needle before you sew. There's someplace you'd rather be than hug.
honey, don't tell me, 'cause I can read between the lines. And I'm just asking for a little more time. Reconsider if it feels like a long, long while. I've got a figure in the back of my mind, there's a tragedy.
Two wonderful picks for this week, grooving into the weekend, Raining Sound with a Little More Time. Thank you, Tony. Tune in for Tony's hosting along with Mark Simmet and CC Mitchell. Wow, what an offering we have at Iowa Public Radio's Studio One. Check it out on the weekend or during the weekdays. Thanks, Tony.
Hey, thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced today by Matt Alvarez, actually Rick Brewer today. Getting mixed up. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Eager to get into the weekend, I guess you could say. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks, and join us again on Monday. If it feels like a long